Good morning and welcome to The Business of Living, the show that brings you strategies and practical solutions for managing your life and career. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella. Well, have you ever been in a situation in the workplace? You know, there's so many people that are out of work, but there's also many, many more, thankfully, that are, you know, gainfully employed. What happens when you experience or witness or observe some wrongdoing on the part of your senior managers or really anybody for that matter? You know, what do you do? I think back in earlier in my career where I was meeting with the president of the company. At that time, I was reporting into the president of the company. We were going through an agenda for a meeting that was going to be coming up in about a week or so. And he was running down through the roster. And now the invitations had already been sent out. So we're going down through the invite, you know, those invited to the meeting. And he comes across a name of a very, you know, senior ranking person, actually the chairman of the board. And said, well, you know, I don't want that person in the meeting, so you're going to have to let them know that the meeting is canceled. And I was flabbergasted. I was relatively new to the company. And I said, you know, I'm thinking, did I hear that right? You know, the president's telling me that, you know, to tell the chairman that the meeting was canceled. I said, well, are we really going to cancel a meeting? And he said, no, but you're going to tell them that the meeting was canceled because I don't want them there. And that was a real head scratcher for me. I had to make a snap decision, you know, one of those ethical dilemmas kind of in the moment. Now, what do I do? And I thought, gosh, if I push back anymore, he's probably going to fire me. And, well, no one will ever know the truth, really. Well, I decided not to make that phone call. I won't draw the story out any longer. The idea, though, here is that throughout my career, I have seen a few things, you know, I'd put on the scale of minor. This was a little bit more major because I was being told by my boss to lie to the chairman of the company, and I knew that it was wrong. I don't know what his motives were at the time. But this is an important topic because I think there's a slight increase, I believe, in wrongdoing in the workplace. When do we blow the whistle? We're going to talk about the whistleblower dichotomy, courage to do the right thing versus fear of retaliation. Of course, that really sums up, you know, my situation. But here to talk about this is the expert. I'm far from the expert. I was, you know, I'm relating a very personal story, and it really caused me a lot of heartache. I was disappointed in the individual. I was disappointed in the company. Anyway, here to speak with us about this is Michael Wilson, a Los Angeles qui tem and entertainment lawyer. Good morning, Michael. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, my first question is qui tem. It sounds Latin. And so what does that mean?
Yes, it's actually very Latin.
If you're going to use the term, you've got to know what it means. So I'm assuming, yeah.
Scott, some people pronounce it qui tam, and some people pronounce it qui tam. Qui tam is Latin, and essentially it generally means he who sues for himself sues for the king. And under various whistleblower laws, mainly what we're speaking about here is the False Claims Act. Where one is a whistleblower, also known as a relator, you're suing on behalf of the United States government for fraud that's committed. And this can be with regards to the healthcare industry, defense subcontracting, and the financial sectors.
Yeah. So, and you know, of course, in my example, you know, that it's this had more to do with, you know, more of an internal thing where the, you know, senior manager had put me on the spot, you know, wanted me to do this, you know, lie essentially to the chairman. So I understand that wouldn't fall under the FCA, and I want to get to that in a second. But just your views first on my particular situation. I mean, how would you counsel somebody in that particular case? Again, this is not something that is going to bring the company down necessarily, but this is an individual, in my case, you know, me, who had you know, experienced this, and, you know, it was a real head scratcher. You know, if he's going to you know, what else might this guy be doing? So how would you counsel somebody in my shoes at that time?
Well, essentially, obviously, when a supervisor or a manager is asking you or requesting of you to do something which you think is immoral or unethical, my advice would be to really kind of do a little bit of investigation, fleshing out what is exactly going on. Some people think they're being discriminated against or harassed. And fraud is like essentially you're unpeeling the layers of an onion. And the more layers you unpeel, the deeper, the core, you find what the real fraud and what the real issues are. And so usually there's a cover-up that occurs. Whether it was myself, I went through this experience myself, or to my clients or friends, you know, I essentially advise them to start, you know, documenting the actions that are being taken. Depending on which, you may want to get an attorney. Always remember this, too. When you go to the human resources department of your company that you work for, ultimately, the human resource department is on the side of the company, not on your side. And that's what you have to be careful about, because at that point, you become essentially, quote-unquote, a marked man.
Or a marked woman. Jill caught that. That's a great point, because it reminds me of I do a lot of corporate counseling and executive coaching, and I was interviewing some mid-level managers who had intimated to me some very serious, you know, allegations about some senior managers that went beyond just they're doing, you know, they're nasty people or mean people. This was there was allegations of fraudulent behavior. They actually did go and try to give the HR person a heads up, and that was really how they had been, you know, trained or coached. But they later found out that the HR person then turned around, rather than dealing with the situation, turned around and gave the senior managers a heads up. And then, of course, the employees were berated and dressed down, so to speak. And they just kind of after that kept their mouth shut. And then when they were meeting with me for a different reason, little by little, they started to volunteer some of this information under the, you know, with the promise that I would keep it confidential. But of course, then, you know, I had to figure out a way to address it with their permission and cooperation. So you're exactly right. See, I think many employees think that, well, let me follow the right process, and HR, they're kind of neutral. I think I can, you know, share whatever information with them. So I'm not, at least I wouldn't suggest necessarily not to do that, but you make a good point. You know, whose payroll are they on? And many corporations also have legal counsel. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that. But again, you're the expert. So how would you advise? And we're really talking here about, you know, serious fraud, especially in the, you know, healthcare industry, the defense contracting, financial industries. We just saw, you know, GSK, GlaxoSmithKline. They got nailed with a $780 million fine for illegal drug marketing. So how would you counsel somebody in this particular situation? Who do they go to then?
Okay, so let me just – it's actually SmithKline just got – they just got dinged for $3 billion. It was Amgen that got fined last year.
Oh, that's right.
$80 million, yeah. So I know it's kind of hard to keep track of that.
$3 billion, that's B as in boy, is that a lot of cash.
Yeah.
Wow, that's right, yeah.
Which a lot of people, even the Justice Department, as a key time attorney, you work with the Justice Department in these cases, and you kind of assist them and investigate the fraud. And with the Justice Department, you know, they said in their statement that, you know, they're tired of, you know, the cost of doing business. You know, they're tired of the big companies of proceeding in that manner. Now, with regards to you specifically, you know, it's interesting, Scott. I would actually, depending where you are in your job, your tenure, what's at risk, you may want to, I would advise you to get an attorney. But even if you have an attorney, you can still be terminated. However, there are remedies at law which may entitle you to recovery. And if I can just use myself as an example, because this is part of, you know, I practice what I know. I'm an entertainment lawyer. I produce films. I have a reality TV submarine show called Going Deep that I'm producing. And under the Quitom, I was actually a whistleblower against my former employee. I was a pharmaceutical sales rep against Bristol-Myers Squibb. In 2007, Bristol-Myers Squibb settled with the Justice Department for $515 million. And there were about seven whistleblowers, myself included. And essentially, back in 2002, I had discovered, you know, a lot of fraud that had been going on at BMS, mainly some of their sample counting that was going on. And so I reported to the human resources. You know, I became targeted. I actually called up the FDA to discuss this matter. And so I actually retained counsel. And in 2004, during a layoff, they actually fired me instead of laying me off. I later found out I had a great, great whistleblower case, which I filed, and BMS settled that case in 2007. There's actually two pending actions, or two other cases against BMS. One is an off-label case for their billion-dollar drug, Plavix, and some other drugs. And then there is another kickback case for bribing physicians on behalf of private insurers under a California law. And so the reason I bring this up is, even if you have an attorney, I had an attorney at the time, BMS, and I actually had filed a case in state court against BMS, they still terminated me. And so I guess the best thing to do in terms of with this regard is you document. Eventually, you probably may be put on some type of disciplinary probation. But I would essentially document everything that's going on, and get an attorney who could give you legal advice. But you know, that doesn't mean you may not be fired.
Well, I believe, unless I'm mistaken here, that Sarbanes-Oxley, also known as SOX, the SOX Act, Section 806, provides a some degree of protection for employees of publicly traded companies who provide evidence of fraud. Now, I don't know how, you know, bulletproof that is. I would imagine that companies, and it seems like, you know, they still, you know, can and do fire people. But is there greater protection from you go back, I think, the story you just related to 2004. Since then, has there been, you know, greater protection for whistleblowers?
Yeah, actually, there has been. The False Claims Act has, you know, been amended. Actually, it was really amended in '86 with President Ronald Reagan. And but always remember that, you know, as an employee, if it's found that you are determined that you have been retaliated against, then under some laws, you will get your job back. You will receive treble damages for your salary. And so there are remedies, but again, you can still be terminated. There's no protection against that. And when you're terminated, generally, it's not, you won't be terminated because, hey, you know, you discovered fraud. It's usually something else that you're being set up on. And so what I mean is, you know, set up is like, okay, have there been instances where your work, you know, fallen below the standards, employee standards? Have you been late? You know, had there been errors at your job? And so those are things that you have to watch out for.
I would imagine it can go from the obvious, again, relative to performance, and you just mentioned a few examples. Also, maybe some more subtle ways where people, let's say, are marginalized or, you know, put out to pasture. So, you know, you're not fired or, you know, terminated right away. But, you know, they make life miserable for you, and to the point where, okay, I'm not going to put up with this. And the person finally just exits on their own. I would imagine there are different ways maybe to, you know, to retaliate. But and again, you're the expert. We're speaking with Michael Wilson, a Los Angeles, let's see if I get this right this time, Quitom and entertainment lawyer, about whistleblowing, the whistleblower dichotomy, courage to do the right thing versus fear of retaliation. I'm also under the understanding that there can be fairly generous rewards for whistleblowers. Not only, you know, I believe it has to result in conviction. Or I don't know. Are you familiar with the this whole idea of a reward system for whistleblowers? Not only to come forward, but also to help the government, you know, win the case.
Yes, Scott. Actually, let me just give you a little bit of background. So the False Claims Act which falls under Quitam law, was enacted in 1863 by President Abraham Lincoln. And essentially at the time, you know, the Civil War was going on, and Lincoln got sick of fraud against the government. And the fraud that was occurring at that time was, for example, instead of being sold, the Union troops, instead of being sold gunpowder, they were being sold sawdust, or their uniforms were dissolving in the rain. So President Abraham Lincoln enacted this law that basically says, you know, he who sues for the U.S. government, sues on behalf of the government, may be entitled to a reward between 15% to 30% of the reward. Mm. So, for example, if a case is settled for $100, then that whistleblower relator may receive between 15% to 30%, which is kind of determined on how much the whistleblower assisted the U.S. government in fleshing out the fraud. And it was amended in 86. So now when you're seeing a lot of cases, I believe there was another Glaxo case that settled for $750 million about a year or two ago. And the whistleblower, Cheryl, I can't remember her last name, but she received about $95 million as a whistleblower.
My gosh. So, you know, that's a nice incentive. You'd think there'd be more people, you know, blowing the whistle, but I would imagine you have to be pretty darn sure that, you know, something's going on. You're taking a risk.
Yes, and that's one of the issues I was going to get into. And I know you wanted to speak about this. So there is an incentive there, and there should probably be more incentives, because it's not like, you know, you're going to file a whistleblower case and 6 months later, hey, you have $95 million. It's a long process. The companies and the defense attorneys really, really dig in. And they fight the U.S. government, they fight the Justice Department on this, and so the investigations last a while. And so there is an incentive, and there should be more of an incentive, because on the other side of it, there's a great risk, and that risk is, you know, ostracism. You're being targeted, you're being blackballed, and essentially you're being blackballed from the industry that you're working in. For me, it was a little different because I was transitioning out of the pharmaceutical industry into being an attorney. So, but I have heard of instances, and I do have clients who do fear once their case is resolved that they can no longer work in that industry.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because it's very rare that I hear about a whistleblowing case where it ended well for the whistleblower. I won't go down through the litany of names, but it exactly what you said. They're blackballed. They are ostracized. They're kind of shut out. And even you know, I think of the Abu Ghraib, which you know, again, it's in a different category. But the person who brought that to light eventually had to would sleep with a gun under his pillow. Because there were death threats. That's how extreme that got. Sharon Watkins, the one who, and actually she never really did blow the whistle, as I understand it. She did write internal memos. She did talk to senior leaders. Hey, what's going on? This is wrong. You know, they had ignored her warnings. I think that I believe that she went on to, you know, the speaking circuit, and so that was probably somewhat lucrative. But as far as I know, I don't believe she's been able to, you know, let's say reintegrate into industry. This is anecdotal, Michael, but is that about right? I mean, does it usually not end well for the whistleblower in your experience?
Actually, you know what? I think it's a case by case basis. There are some people who've done really well, and they've moved on to other industries. Some people have received such large awards that essentially they're retired. You know, the laws have changed, and so whistleblowers are protected. The fear of actual retaliation in terms of, you know, is your car going to blow up or something like that, I seriously doubt that, you know. I mean, but, you know, never say never, depending what type of fraud it is. But
we're living in crazy times.
Yeah. But in general, I mean, I think the American taxpayer and the American public in general, I think they're sick of the fraud. You know, it's occurred for several years now, and everyone's sick of paying these high health care costs for medications. And this is one of the reason why, is because of some of the pharmaceutical companies and device companies do. in terms of inducing physicians to prescribe or implant devices. And so I think now there's a lot of support for whistleblowers, and it's gaining more momentum. In fact, in some companies, the whistleblowers, even though they've come away with several millions of dollars, you know, Daniel Richardson, who was a district manager with BMS, in the kickback case, he was one of the whistleblowers. I mean, he's still employed with Bristol-Myers Squibb, and he was one of the main whistleblowers. So, I mean, you know, that's an issue now in terms of, like, there's a lot more protection for whistleblowers. Yep. And I honestly feel that if you discover fraud, I mean, you should. I honestly believe that you should do the right thing. But, Scott, I do want to say one thing. Under the law, the False Claims Act, there's a big difference in discovering fraud and what you may think is immoral versus illegal.
That's right.
Illegal can be investigated and pursued by the Justice Department, and there will be hopefully eventually some type of action taken against the companies. Immoral, that's a totally different issue.
And that's an very important distinction, right? You know, so something may be legal yet immoral, but that's not, you know, the government's not going to get involved in immorality. So here's the question I have is, I know one of the articles I read regarding some of these settlements, and earlier in the show, we mentioned, you know, Glaxo, where there was a $3 billion settlement, and then Amgen, $780 million. Do some of these companies, some of these corporations just kind of bake this into their business plan? In other words, actually budget for fines? You know, they just do the kind of the risk analysis, right? So, you know, here's the cost benefit, and yeah, we'll pay the fine, and not necessarily thinking about, you know, the public relations, the negative public relations. But is there some truth to that, that companies will actually, you know, budget to, you know, pay out these fines based on a, you know, cost benefit analysis?
Oh, I definitely think so. Especially with, say, for example, a couple years ago, Pfizer was fined $2.3 billion. And this wasn't the first time they were fined.
Right.
CNN actually did a piece on them and said, you know, essentially that's about 3 months of their annual revenue.
And that was, I think, based on some of their salespeople misrepresenting a drug. Is that correct? The Pfizer?
Yeah, there was two main issues in the area. One was kickbacks to physicians for their sales reps. Another area was off-label, which means that a doctor can prescribe or implant a device off-label.
Right.
It's illegal for companies to promote or market the device or the drug to
other
the
than its intended use.
Yeah, indicated by the FDA. Mm. So, and what happens, and that's a good point you bring up, because what happens is that I think it is built into the business plan. It's the cost of doing business. I mean, Glaxo settled for $3 billion, but really they were probably discounted. The money was actually discounted in terms of settlement, so their damages probably was a lot greater than $3 billion. And in general, most of the settlements are civil. Now, the Glaxo case did involve a criminal fine. However, that's against the company, not against the individuals. And so a lot of marketing execs, what happens is that, you know, and sales reps, you know, your compensation is also included in terms of your sales, you know, the increase of your sales performance. And, you know, there's stock options awarded, you know, the greater new prescriptions that you generate as an employee, the greater your salary will be. And so people take this into consideration. They say, well, if I'm not going to be criminally liable and it's just the company,
why not?
You know what? Exactly. Because I can go out and buy that new Beamer next week, yeah. You know, or next year.
Follow the money. We're going to take a short break. We're speaking with Michael Wilson. Michael is a Los Angeles Quitom and entertainment lawyer. You're listening to the Business of Living Show. We'll be right back here at 1490 WGCH. Welcome back. You're listening to The Business of Living, the show that brings you strategies and practical solutions for managing your life and career. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella, and we're speaking with Michael Wilson. Michael is a Los Angeles Quitom and entertainment lawyer. I'm just practicing that. Practice. I think I'm getting pretty close. And Michael also has a website. It's michaelwilsonesquire.com. I'm going to spell that. M as in Mary, YCHALWILSONESQ.com. MichaelWilsonEsquire.com. Michael, thank you for joining us once again. We're speaking today. The topic is the whistleblower dichotomy, courage to do the right thing versus fear of retaliation. I mean, it's pretty tempting. I'm thinking about this that, gee, maybe I got to find some kind of a gig, you know, get in with one of these companies, you know, do a little bit of digging and see if I can, you know, come up with some kind of a nice payout. But that's not the way to think, is it, Michael?
No, Scott, it's not, you know. I mean,
oh, come on. You know, times are tough.
So, you know, if you want to do that, you might as well play the lottery.
I probably have a better shot. Yeah, you're right. Okay. Now, you're going to charge me for that advice? Send it to Jill.
No.
Send the big tab to. So I would imagine there are psychological and financial considerations when you're trying to decide whether to do the right thing, or maybe somebody's not even quite sure. I mean, what kind of guidance would you give somebody? You know, I mean, do you have to be almost absolutely sure, or you have some, are you, you know, if you're a little bit suspicious, is that enough of a reason? You know, what are some of the considerations?
Okay. So the main thing, if you're going to blow the whistle, okay, the primary reason why you would do it, it involves your character, and I believe it involves justice. And that's the fabric of that character, that person who becomes a whistleblower. It's not for the financial incentive, the risk of it. I mean, the reward. You may, as a whistleblower, go through a lot. You may go through some depression, some anxiety. There's some whistleblowers who eventually file for bankruptcy because they lost their job and they're banned from the industry. Some go through divorce. So if you're looking to blow the whistle for the reward, you know, you may want to think about other career options. The best advice in terms of looking to do something is, you know, there's a lot of research you can do on the net, and to think, you know, to really realize if you have if your claim is has merits. The main thing is you want to have an attorney that has experience, who has the connections with the Justice Department. I myself, you know, I was a whistleblower. Right now, I have several cases under seal. Civil additional matters that are being investigated. And I work with other big law firms and also fraud examiners. So we have a whole team that we, you know, we get together and you know, work on these cases. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead, please.
And so it becomes a whole team, and we assist the Justice Department. So it's about being a team player.
Got it.
In fleshing out this fraud.
You know, it's interesting. I teach a business ethics class at an undergraduate level, and when we cover the topic of whistleblowing, and I ask my students, now they're 20, you know, early 20s, and I ask them, you know, would you do this, whether it's to do the right thing or the payout? But almost unanimously, Michael, and this really shocks me, is that they say, no way. And you know why? It's tattling. You know, I'm not going to rat my, you know, somebody out, whether they're a friend or not. You know, I'm not going to call them out. Let somebody else do that, because I don't want to be labeled a rat.
Right. And, you know, that's something to take into consideration. But I can tell you this, Scott. You're working in the corporate world and you feel bad about, there's a lot of people I know who felt bad about being the rat. And unfortunately, there were layoffs in the company, and you know they've been unemployed. Mm. They no longer have a job. Some have filed for bankruptcy. You know, some have lost their house to foreclosure. And so, when you talk about in this modern age of loyalty to a corporation or a company, I mean, essentially, you know, from my perspective, is that you're essentially a number. And when your number is called, you know, it's hey, great, thanks for all the money you've generated for this company. Feel it. No, that's not, you know, the case with every corporation, but, you know, I think ultimately you have to look out for yourself. And, you know, there is a loyalty to your peers, but, you know, I represent people who are insiders in companies. I represent, I have friends who are actually doctors, physicians who are sick of the fraud. I mean, these are top-notch cardiovascular surgeons in Los Angeles or, you know, other areas of medicine who come to me and they say, hey, I got to tell you something. I'm sick of this fraud. This has got to stop. It's affecting not just my medical practice, but it's affecting, you know, my patients. So, you know, it seems like things are opening up today for whistleblowers.
Well, that's good news. And, Michael, thank you so much for what you do. People are fed up. And it's great to have folks like you who are willing to, you know, kind of step up and begin to, you know, address this very important issue. We've been speaking with Michael Wilson, a Los Angeles QUITOM and entertainment lawyer. Coming up, we'll be speaking with Peter Bedard about treating chronic health conditions. When Western medicine goes south, simply head east. Good morning and welcome to The Business of Living, the show that brings you strategies and practical solutions for managing your life and career. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella. Well, in this particular segment, we're going to be talking about managing your health. Not too long ago, a colleague of mine and I were meeting, and she shared with me a personal story about how she had gotten bitten by an infected tick came down with Lyme disease. It went undiagnosed. First of all, many medical doctors, you know, some don't even want to acknowledge that this exists, or, you know, they don't want to test for it or whatever. And like I said, the test can be very unreliable. Well, she came down with a very, very bad case, and over $100,000 later, and I won't take you through all of the trials and travails there, but she was still suffering several years later with chronic headaches, chronic fatigue. And, of course, the symptoms might have mirrored other kinds of illnesses, but this was related to Lyme. And I remember her telling me that she, after a while, just got used to, you know, these headaches, where it became the new norm for her. And she tried everything from the traditional treatments for Lyme, you know, starting with the antibiotics, went to a PICC line and had, you know, IV antibiotics, to some of the less conventional methods, acupuncture, changing her diet, massage therapy, and I won't even go down through the litany. But she said that she never gave up. She kept trying. And one day she was at a client's office and she went into the kitchen to get some coffee. And she said, as she related the story to me, she said, I suddenly noticed that something was wrong. And those were her words. Something was wrong. And I said, well, what was it? What was wrong? And she said, my headaches were gone. The pain was gone. And she said, I'd lived so long with it that I forgot what it was like to feel good. So fortunately for her, you know, there was a good ending. But for so many other people, they continue to suffer with chronic pain, with chronic illness. So today's topic is when Western medicine goes south, simply head east. I love that topic. And this is not my topic. It's not my saying, but I do love it. It's Peter Bedard's, who's now joining us. Peter is an MA and CHT. We'll ask him what that means. He works with people dealing with chronic health conditions and is also a staff therapist for Passages. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hey there. Thank you for having me on.
So, okay, you got to start with MA CHT. You got a lot of initials there. That sounds very serious.
Oh, isn't it? You know, I have a funny thing about all those credentials. You know, just because somebody has all those letters after their name doesn't mean they know what they're doing. And I have a few letters, but I have a lot of life experiences helps me know what I'm doing. So I'm just saying that because a lot of people get caught up on those letters and that only certain people can help them heal. And I'm going to challenge that, and we're going to challenge that a little bit today. But what those letters mean is that I have a master's degree in consciousness studies. And consciousness studies is the study of quantum theory combined with theology. So it's truly a science and religion degree. It was pretty fantastic. It's one of my favorite things and the best things I've ever really done in my life to actually break that myth of duality in that region
this,
of us.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're going to need a couple of hours for this show, I think. But no, it is fascinating. And I just a very quick sidebar, then we'll get back on track here. But years ago, I worked with the founder of the Peel Center, as in Norman Vincent Peale, and the Peale family had started a number of different organizations. One is a publishing company, Guidepost, and there was the Peale Center. But there was also the Institute for Science and Religion that was, and it still is, based down in New York City. So, and I believe Dr. Peale, who was the Methodist minister, had teamed up with the psychologist, Dr. Smiley Blanton, and the two of them kind of joined forces. Now, I don't know enough about your practice or about, you know, the philosophy around CHT, but it sounds similar. In other words, what they were looking to do was find a connection between, you know, spirituality, religion, and health, and also the behavioral sciences.
Absolutely,
psychology,
that was my degree. So
right. Okay.
It's a pretty cool thing.
But I love you made a comment about and as I read a little bit about your background, you're not just somebody who, you know, is there to help other people. I mean, you've from what I've read, you've experienced chronic pain. It's almost it sounds like you were faced with a heal thyself situation. Is that correct?
Absolutely, and that's what I say a lot of the times is that nobody else could do it for me, and I think that's something that we have to learn really, truly, on a fundamental, even a cellular level, that no one else can do it for you. That's one of the gifts of this world. It's also one of the trials of living in this world, that you can't count on other people to fix you, and I think that's the biggest problem that most Americans have, is we're always going to other people to be fixed, and it's the problem of our medical institutions, because they're always telling us that they are in charge and they know what's best for us and that they're the only ones that can fix us, and they're failing, unfortunately. And when I work with a number of medical people, and I think there's a waking up in the medical profession where people are understanding that, you know, they've gone to school for all these years, they have these credentials, they have this background, and really, they only have two methods of healing available to them. It's either pharmaceutical drugs that have huge numbers of side effects, which I deal with all the time when I see my clients at Passages. And then the second tool is either surgery. And when those things don't work, such as with the story you told about your friend with the Lyme disease, when those things just don't work, or they only do one thing at a time, which I think is a mistake. I think we should do combination therapies. Mm. But when they only do that, or those are the only choices that they have available to them, you don't succeed. One of the big things I work on in my private practice is to have a healing method that goes on all levels of our being. So we make the mistake, and this isn't about religion, but we make the mistake of thinking we only exist on one level. And most of us are convinced that we only exist on the physical level. Well, we have a mind as well, and we have a spiritual side to us as well. And when you do true healing that is lasting, that isn't, oh, my cancer went away and then it came back a year later. When you do true healing, you actually affect that healing on all levels of your being, the body, the mind, and the spirit. And it's so important to hit all those points. And that's, again, why I say combination therapies. You have to really be going at it. Like, if I was to interview your friend with a Lyme disease, I'd probably discover that she became, one thing that was good is that she came, in a way, resigned to her disease. She wasn't looking for it anymore. So that's a good thing on one side of the coin, that she wasn't actually looking to be sick anymore. It just was something that was going on in her life. Because when we look for our sicknesses, we continue creating it.
That's really interesting, and I think that you're right. It wasn't that she was just giving up or resigned to the fact that this was going to be her fate. I think that she had just kind of reconciled that, okay, this is my reality right now, and to her credit, you know, she really never gave up. She continued to seek out, and I love that term, combination therapies. I think of my 83-year-old mom who had a – now, this was a heart valve situation, I would imagine, at that age, and I think this is something she had been living with for a few years, but it got to a point where they said, okay, we've got to do the surgery. But right now, I think we're counting about a dozen different medications that you know, and that's pretty much, you know, her existence right now. Her day is just taking these medications at the right. prescribed times and the prescribed dosages. Is she any better? Not really.
Right. And that's very common. And it's not necessarily that the drugs aren't working. It could be that the drugs can't work because of what you're holding on an emotional cellular level. And so, there, you know, it's based on the idea. Every time we have, there's two things. Every time we have a judgment and opinion, I believe we bring ourselves closer to our graves. And I'm guilty of it. I have judgments and opinions all the time, and I consciously try to be as best I can as to remove them from my consciousness. And the second thing is to actually realize that every disease, and I like to say dis-ease, every dis-ease, that state of being that is not at ease, has an emotional and spiritual element to it. So it's not uncommon when I work with my cancer patients to find out that there's something that say they couldn't stomach, something that happened to them, maybe in their childhood, maybe in their recent past. Generally, there's oftentimes something between a 6-month and an 18-month period that occurs before the cancer becomes diagnosed. But something that they couldn't stomach, let's say, that they didn't deal with emotionally, and mm-hmm. they just stuffed down, and their body had to deal with all of that pain or that misery or whatever it is, that unhappiness. And so you push those emotions in your body, and one of my clients said to me the other day, it's like they come out sideways.
Hmm.
And every time you say, nope, can't feel that, can't, don't have time for that, don't want to deal with that, you push it into your body, and then your body has to deal with it. Eventually, it's got to come out some way, and if it's not coming out by directly addressing it, it's going to come out sideways. And it comes out in all kinds of diseases.
This is, I'm fascinated because I was visiting with my mom on Saturday, and she was kind of bent over, and I said, well, what hurts? What's wrong? Is it I just don't feel well. And I thought, well, you know, maybe you're a little bit depressed because of the, you know, the operation was major. It was open heart surgery. It was just a couple of months ago. But then she really couldn't put her finger on it. And I thought that, so it's very interesting when you say the emotional and spiritual and how that could have an impact and actually maybe work against some of these medications that she's taking. And I don't want to use that as the only example, but I would also imagine, you're the expert, not me, but I would think that that could work both ways. So in other words, that whole mind body, that if we're, you know, if we have filled our mind with these negative thoughts and have maybe generated some negative conclusions, I would imagine that has a negative impact on our health. But vice versa, that if we have maybe some positive thoughts and we look maybe at some of the positive aspects, you know, in our lives, or in and around our lives, that maybe that would have a positive effect on the body. So I don't know. Again, these are just thoughts that are coming to
absolutely.
My head. You're the expert.
Well, you're
right. I don't have all those letters in front, you know, following my name.
Well, you're right on key. It's exactly the truth. You know, when we are upset, our body feels bad. When we're happy, our body feels better. So one of the big things to learn, that is, if you are sick, try to find whatever way you can, or not try, find whatever way you can to psychically, emotionally feel better. To put your focus and attention on those things, and your body will eventually respond to that. So if you can shift your thinking, if you decide to go the Western allopathic route and you do drugs and surgery, make it possible for the drugs and surgery to work by having that mindset, that knowing that in your faith it is going to work. Faith is a really big part of healing, and I don't necessarily mean dogmatic or even spiritual faith. I mean just the belief, like your friend had, where she didn't give up, that eventually she was going to feel better.
What would be some other concrete examples about how you can change that mindset? Is it, you know, just put yourself in a different surrounding? Is it listening to music? I mean, what are some examples?
Well, each person has to figure it out for themselves, because, and that's the beauty of Eastern therapies, is that there may be a sort of suggested protocol, just like there is in Western therapies, but it's never the same for one particular person. When I work with somebody, I have a little step process that we go through, and I won't work with somebody if they're not willing to satisfy the first step of the process. And that first step is that they get to take responsibility for their lives. So they get to, and the second step of that is, in taking responsibility, they release the victim. And that victim thinking that says, I'm worthless, I'm no good, I can't change, I'm the old dog, you know, old dog can't learn new tricks, that whole thinking, or the I don't know how, I don't know what it looks like, all of that has to change. That victim thinking, that old way of being that wants to pull you back to that familiarity of being sick. Most people, when they do have some sort of dis-ease in their lives, are engaged in victim thinking. On some level, they may be, you know, these amazing, powerful, really strong people, but then when it comes to their health or their personal relationships, everything goes south.
I love it. So take responsibility, number one.
Yep.
And number two, you got to let that go. You got to release that victim mentality.
Absolutely. Anything that brings you back. It's that little voice in your head, even if it's just, the bane of the U.S., which is weight loss issues. Even if it's that little voice in your head that says, oh, just one more piece of cake, it's okay. That right there is the victim. That little voice that says, hey, go
you deserve
have
it.
A cigarette.
You deserve it. That's right.
Exactly. And that's the victim disguised as some supportive, loving, you know, kind of being inside you. You know, but it's really destroying you. So every time you listen to that victim voice and you go and smoke that cigarette, do those drugs, have that random sex, you know, eat that piece of cake, whatever it is, every time you engage that behavior, you're actually activating the victim. So fighting that victim is so important. So I won't take anybody on in my practice unless they are willing to take responsibility for who they are, how they are, which, a little personal note, if I may.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, I was slammed into the back of a semi-truck. I had a guy come behind me. There was a parked semi-truck on the side of the street, and he hit my back tire and literally pushed my moped into the semi-truck. I shattered
my
knee. I cracked my vertebrae. I split my wrist open. I had brain damage. I lost all the nerves in my right hand. I had to learn how to walk. I had 20 years of chronic pain. Now, for me, I could be in that victim, and our culture would enable that. Our culture would say, oh, you've had such a hard life, poor you. It makes so much sense that you've not achieved what you want to do or be, you know, how you want to be. And we're going to, like,
we'll take care of you.
We'll
take this from you. Mm-hmm. You don't worry about it. You've been through enough, poor thing.
Exactly. And although that's a good quality, as far as I think we need to take care of more of our people.
Have that compassion, yeah.
Exactly, and we don't do that on one end. We don't physically take care of our people, and then we criticize them for being sick, but it has to start on a internal level. And I can no longer be the victim to the man that pushed me into the semi-truck. So if I keep thinking that I'm the victim, and I don't care if you were raped, if you were abused, or whatever it is, if I keep thinking that victim and I keep making him responsible for who I am and how I am, I'm never going to heal. So when I forgive him and I say, you know what, I can even say screw you if I need to have an attitude about it, but you know what, I don't need that energy anymore in my life, and I am no longer going to be the victim to this person's abuse. And in releasing the victim, I no longer need to continue that person's abuse.
Peter, this is just what I'm sorry to interrupt. What a profound concept, because I think there are so many people that just simply can't let it go. We're going to take a short break. We're speaking with Peter Bedard, MACHT. We're talking about how to deal with chronic illnesses, and the topic is when Western medicine goes south, simply head east. When we come back, we'll talk about some of those alternative methods. You're listening to the Business of Living Show. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella. Be right back here at 1490 WGCH. Welcome back. You're listening to The Business of Living, the show that brings you strategies and practical solutions for managing your life and career, and in this case, your health. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella. We're speaking with Peter Bedard, MACHT, and someone who deals with people that are addressing chronic health issues. A chronic health condition. He's also a staff therapist for Passages. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Scott.
And so you shared a little bit about your personal story, and it sounds like you were somebody who not necessarily gave up on, you know, Western methods, but perhaps in addition to that, you know, you looked eastward. And tell us a little bit about that and some of the therapies that that you are personally familiar with and also use in your practice.
Sure. Well, the beautiful thing about holistic therapies or even Eastern type of therapies is that they generally do not have any interactive issues with Western therapies. You always want to make sure, especially if you're doing cancer meds or something like that, but the overall holistic therapies have no side effects and won't bother whatever issues you look into doing. So one of the types of therapy that I'm really fond of that has been great for me, you know, we have acupuncture and we have Chinese medicine. People are really aware of that. So I don't want to go too much into that, but it's been really fantastic. I had sciatica so bad I couldn't walk. And the acupuncture completely wiped out my sciatica. Now, but the another therapy that's often overlooked in the United States is Ayurvedic therapy. And the beauty of Ayurvedic therapy is they treat each person as an individual. So nothing is ever prescribed to the person that isn't going to be effective to their diagnosed body type, who they are, even their emotional type, their physical type, and even their spiritual type. So there's a few therapies that are really exceptional when it comes to the Ayurvedic tradition. One of them is Griva or Kati Janubhasti, and it's pretty amazing. It is a type of therapy that will basically create a bowl of dough. And they'll put this bowl of dough, dough will, like bread even, like a wet dough, the unbaked bread, and they put that around the area that is in pain, whether it's your knee or lower back, and they pour hot oils in that area, and the dough creates like a little dam and creates a place for the oils to sit. It's really effective to pull out problems in knee joints and lower back joints. So another way, if you're still having your sciatica issues, this could be really good for you. It would be called Kati Basti. Kati meaning lower back and Basti meaning container, like the container the dough creates.
And full disclosure, I'm an avid runner. In fact, yesterday I just went out and did about 14 miles. So I think I bring this on myself. But I don't want to stop. You know, I enjoy it so much. I don't want to stop. So, and I have not heard of these alternative methods.
Well, there are Ayurvedic doctors all over the United States, though, so I'm sure you'll be able to find one.
You just answered my question. Now, do you have a website? Is that correct? Is it createyourhealth.com?
There's createyourhealth.com as well. And Create Your Health is turning into – it's a little pet project of mine where I'm interviewing healers about what they do.
Okay.
And every now and then I'll put on some blogs and I'll put on some video about healers. And you get to actually go and watch what they do, and they treat me as their guinea pig. So you can go to that website if you wanted to explore a little bit more about some holistic alternative therapies. And if you want to go check out my personal website, that's Peter Bedard Hypnotherapy at peterbedardhypnotherapy.com.
And Bedard is B as in boy, E, D as in David, A, R, D as in David.
You got it.
So Peter Bedard Hypnotherapy?
.com. And I want to talk to you more, if you have time, even off the phone, about your back, because I've had some things that might be able to help you.
Good. Well, good. I love it. Fantastic. I'm talking to the right person, it sounds. Peter, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all for joining us on the Business of Living show. We will see you around again next week. Thank you so much for joining us. Remember, you only have one life. Why not live it on purpose? This is Scott Ventrella here at 1490 WGCH. Thank you.